Aguilar, and this is your call. The COVID-19 death toll in the United States passed 170,000 this week. We've now had an average of more than 1,000 deaths per day over the past 3 weeks, according to New York Times data. COVID is now the third leading cause of death behind heart disease and cancer, according to the CDC. Americans are 8 times more likely than Europeans to die from COVID. Here are the latest numbers from Johns Hopkins. There have been almost 5.5 million positive cases in the U.S. 171,865 people have died. Black, Latino, Native American, and Alaskan Native people were disproportionately hospitalized for COVID from late April to late June, according to an analysis of 12 state populations published Monday in the journal JAMA Internal Medicine. 6 months in, and we still don't have a national plan. Experts say without one, there is no end in sight. So where does that leave us? Today, we are joined by Dr. Eric Fagelding, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, an epidemiologist, and a health economist. Hi, Eric. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Well, Eric, you sounded the alarm about COVID back in January. And here we are. It's the middle of August. How do you assess where we are today?
Well, yeah, it's certainly been a long 7 months of watching kind of like a oncoming train wreck unfold, because in January we had like so many signals that this was going to be really, really bad coming out from China. Yet we punted, we ignored, we basically tried to pretend that, you know, it won't happen or hit our shores. It's incredibly frustrating, obviously, when it first hit, because there was late testing. But in certain ways, you shrugged and then said, okay, well, we'll learn from that. But here we are all these months later, and we're still short on PPEs. We're still bottlenecked with testing and slow and delayed reporting. And we're still uncoordinated in terms of our national response, as well as our state-level responses. And right now, people are ignoring science and evidence to reopen and push the business to reopen, all in the name of profits and hoping that it will go away. So it's incredibly frustrating overall.
Given that we don't have a national plan, where does that leave us?
It leaves us in this chaotic whack-a-mole situation with the epidemic in different states. The analogy I always want people to remember is the U.S. is not quite like any other country. It's not like Europe, where Italy can shut off its borders, France can shut off its borders. It's really hard for the U.S. to shut off its borders from other U.S. states. So pretend the U.S. is a big ship and we can't close compartments to contain any leaks, that as long as there's leaks within any state, the whole ship will still continue to sink. And right now, without leadership, it's every state for themselves in many ways. And even if you contain it, your neighboring state might not, and the epidemic will still continue to burn. And that's the situation, literally, where we are in, that as long as the epidemic keeps flaring up in any state, the rest of the states are all still in danger. And that's the real function of not having a national plan.
Right. And I think it's safe to say that we probably won't have a national plan unless Joe Biden wins in November. I mean, that's just a fact. I was looking on Donald Trump's Twitter feed this morning. I mean, the man is ripping on Goodyear tires for not selling MAGA hats. I mean, this is just... What do you even say at this point?
Right now, I have very low confidence, but, you know, he says he would want people to wear masks. Well, then encourage your governors to ask for mask mandates. Instead, his governors in the South that are loyal to him, like, you know, DeSantis and Kemp. Kemp actually, Governor Kemp of Georgia actually has an opposite mandate. He has an executive order banning any cities or counties in Georgia from imposing mask mandates. And that is the exact opposite of what we want to be. So altogether, I don't have much hope for the federal. The only thing I hope for is that we get a vaccine soon, but obviously with enough safety testing. That's funding the vaccine research is the only major hopeful that we can hope from the federal government, aside from signing any coronavirus stimulus bills.
So let's just say Joe Biden wins in November. He takes office in January. So far, he said that he supports a national mask mandate. What else could he actually do to get this under control?
Yeah, there's actually many. You can actually invoke the Defense Production Act, which basically puts us in a wartime footing for mass production of critical essential things. Obviously, during wartime, you start producing a lot of wartime supplies, but they could do it for PPEs. That's what we really need. Except Trump right now has invoked it for burgers and sausages at meatpacking plants instead. But having the DPA, Defense Production Act, invoked for PPEs, for testing supplies and reagents, and also certain things like the hospital reporting could be better, because the current Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, only reports state-level things such as hospitalization. They don't report the county level. They could actually report at the county level, because that's what we need more than state level. Because state level, the states could actually provide that, but we need county-level things. And all these things make such a difference at the national level. And CDC guidelines also make huge difference if only we actually set them for school reopening. But right now, there are absolutely no CDC guidelines for reopenings. And that's really frustrating. All these things could change once an administration changes. The unfortunate thing is it's January just so far.
Right. Well, there's so much to talk about. I first want to talk about the death toll. 171,865 deaths, and I think the CNN headline says it all. Few signs of collective mourning as the U.S. tops 170,000 deaths. And just doing research for the show, Eric, what's so incredibly sad is that so many of these people are dying alone.
Yeah, absolutely. The deaths, we've kind of become numb to the death count, and that's actually really sad. 170,000 deaths. If you think about it, 3,000 deaths was the death count for 9/11, and the collective mourning for that was obviously a really, really large. 170,000 is like, it's so many 9/11s that it is just boggles the mind. But yet here we are. We basically have another 9/11 death count every 2 to 3 days. I think, you know, the collective mourning, obviously, it is hard when, the President of the United States starts tweeting about Goodyear tires and Goya beans when it's being ignored. You know, this is why the Commander-in-Chief is also so important, where he or she should be the moral compass of the country. But we don't have that. And I think even when it blows past 200, it's going to be extremely frustrating. Because the other day, you know, Trump attacked Michelle Obama for mocking her for saying that her speech was outdated and pre-taped a long time ago because her death count was wrong. So he's actually bragging that the death count is actually much higher than she actually had said. That's the inherent problem. We have no moral compass right now, and unless we have action and moral compass, and where people realize this is so hard, we all need to mask up to protect our elderly, our infirm, and protect our children's development so they can go back to school. We're not getting out of this anytime soon, and this we're going to blow past a 250,000 at this rate before the end of the year, and that's what's even sadder.
The New York Times reports that more than 40% of the deaths are linked to nursing homes. At least 68,000 residents and workers have died from COVID at nursing homes and other long-term facilities in the United States.
Yeah, that number is sobering, and I actually think it's probably an undercount. If anything, the number of excess deaths is actually much higher than the number of COVID deaths, and some of them are really COVID-related as well. And nursing homes is just the tip of the iceberg because they're actually measured and tracked pretty well. Oftentimes, people who die at home, they're not well adjudicated as well. Altogether, the number of deaths is really sobering. And even if young people die less, they keep spreading it, right? And they spread it to the elderly. There's one case today of someone, an elderly person, was stayed at home for 4 months, but ultimately was infected by someone who delivered groceries to them. It is just so darn infectious. And especially if it's insidious property that has asymptomatic transmission, and it spreads via aerosols. And aerosol basically are these airborne microdroplets, the ones that can float more than 6 feet and hang in the air for 20 minutes to 4 hours, depending on ventilation. That just makes it all the harder to contain. And nursing homes are obviously a perfect petri dish, but there was an analysis done of all the risk factors. Is it the age, or is it that the elderly have more disease risk factors? And it actually turns out that for deaths, it could actually be elderly and other chronic disease risk factors that's more important than age. So age, it becomes much weaker, or if not the key factor, once you account for all the risk factors in America. And the number one risk factor in America, obesity. Mm-hmm. That's also the sad truth. So nursing homes is a real risk, but at the same time, there's so many others in the community who are susceptible who are not elderly.
Can you talk a little bit more about this? The New York Times wrote about this a few days ago. They write, an analysis of thousands of patients treated at a Southern California health system identified extreme obesity as an independent risk factor for dying among COVID patients, most strikingly among younger and middle-aged adults, 60 and younger, and particularly among men.
Right. That was a large study. And the study basically analyzed all these risk factors for dying. And morbid obesity definitely stood out. And specifically, it was stronger for men than for women. So obesity in men was much stronger than obesity in women. If anything, women, the results were much weaker for obesity. And we also know that men do suffer from this virus more than women. So these risk factors, I think, honestly, are more important because they actually highlight who will suffer these extreme events. Because this virus really is unusual. There are young people who are cut down by this disease, and then there are those who barely suffer anything at all. There are so many, I think, also heart disease. Risk factor is another major thing. Brain and central nervous system disease is oftentimes a function of being infected. And then there's the long-term sequelae of chronic illness, chronic fatigue, and other lung damage long-term. This is such a pernicious virus in that way that we have to really focus on ending it, not just hand-waving and say, but as some governors say, well, we still have hospital beds capacity. We still have hospital beds that are empty. Because if anything, saying that we have hospital beds free is not logical, because could you say that for, we don't need to buckle our seatbelts? We have hospital beds that are empty. We don't need to wear helmets. We have hospital beds that are empty. We don't need to take precautions such as wearing a condom to prevent STDs. We have hospital beds empty. That is not in any way a public health strategy whatsoever. Mm. So for governors and other leaders to invoke them, whenever in face of an looming crisis, to refuse to lock down, refuse to put mask mandates simply because they have hospital beds empty. That is not a strategy, absolutely whatsoever.
When you think about the pre-existing conditions that people have, for example, obesity, in the health field, are you all talking about the importance of prevention and, I mean, really kind of getting at these issues before they happen? Because in this country, because of the lack of health care, so many people tend to deal with issues after they happen.
Yeah. You know, the saying, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. An ounce of mask wearing and prevention is worth, days and weeks in the ICU and the hospital. But we're a very reactionary society. You know, no one, the problem in public health is no one thanks someone in public health for preventing a disease they would have had. And because A, it's hard to identify. But, you know, say you put a traffic light anywhere, and because a lot of people were being killed at this crosswalk, the next year no one dies. No one thanks you for doing that, putting that crosswalk and walking signal there. And that's the reaction to almost everything in public health. We've defunded public health for so many years and neglected it. And again, oftentimes rich philanthropists donate only after they survive, say, a cancer or some major illness, and they donate to hospitals instead of actually the public health system that would have saved more lives. And that is just the God's honest, sad truth that we are reactionary for things. And, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. But almost always we fail to plan or fail to fund public health prevention. And yet here we are.
Right. And then this is for another show, but I want to do a whole week-long series about the state of our health and the lack of healthy food available for people, especially now as people are struggling to make ends meet.
Oh, yeah. Right now, in terms of people were, I also do nutrition research, and the state of our diet in America is just horrible, and that's part of the reason why there's such high obesity and diabetes in the United States. Yet right now, food insecurity of any sort, just not just healthy food, is a looming problem for so many of the unemployed and with poor food access. And so this nutrition issue will only get worse. And again, we said obesity and diabetes are a major risk factor. And sadly, we're trying to solve one problem with hunger, but also feeding the epidemic with our poor nutrition. Mm-hmm. So it's a vicious cycle in many ways, right? And our children staying home in our lockdowns only promotes more sedentary activity and poor development. Altogether, this is every vulnerability in the United States, from poor nutrition, inadequate food, poor exercise, and so many things in our healthcare system, like lack of preventive healthcare and healthcare access, are all exacerbating and feeding into this pandemic. And that's why we're also stuck at the same time, because we have the systemic public health crisis.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Eric Fagelding, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, an epidemiologist, and a health economist. Dr. Fagelding sounded the alarm about COVID-19 back in January. If you have a question or a comment about what we now know about COVID, and I mean, the fact is we just don't have a national plan and we don't see one coming. So where does that leave us? It's kind of a whack-a-mole what we're seeing across the country. Even county to county, there are different policies. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Before we move off of the death rate, do we have any new research just about why some people pass and others don't? Any new research about treatments?
In terms of treatments, the convalescent plasma is still being debated. There's some evidence now that it does lower mortality from 20 to 35%, comparing convalescent plasma with high antibodies versus plasma with little or low antibodies. But that's still not a trial. And you know, hydroxychloroquine is, I hope, we don't talk about anymore unless we actually have actual trial evidence that works. You know, there's dexamethasone, but that only works for people on oxygen and intubation, but not any earlier, healthier, milder patients, which actually could make it worse. There's a few other smaller drugs, like obviously remdesivir, shortened disease illness. There is some emerging evidence for certain vitamins could reduce coronavirus. For example, vitamin C is known to previously shorten the duration of common cold, but none of them are panaceas. I don't think vitamins are. And please do not listen to my pillow guy for any supplements he's peddling, because that's been the last 2 days of trying to debunk dietary supplements that are completely unproven that he's peddling. Ultimately, it's going to be a vaccine. The vaccine is far away. I think the other key thing is rapid testing is this other key component. And by rapid testing, I don't mean just ramping up PCR testing in the clinic. I mean actually the saliva-based tests, these antigens for saliva. They're less sensitive, so they don't pick up as many. Say you have 100 cases. It doesn't pick up quite as many as the regular conventional PCR test, but they're cheap. They're basically a strip of paper you put in your tongue, your saliva, and they'll tell you results within minutes. That could actually yield better results because there's no bottleneck of testing. And even if you pick up 75% of the cases that you would compared to other testing procedures, you're going to capture so much more because these tests are pennies a piece. And if we make them as cheap and easy as brushing your teeth every morning, it could actually be a really, really amazing public health strategy to reduce people's exposure if only they knew, right? Because so much of the asymptomatic transmission is completely silent. Anywhere from 30 to 50% of the cases could be asymptomatic. And these people, oftentimes younger, who are asymptomatic will keep transmitting it to adults and other more vulnerable sick people. So if we had these rapid paper saliva tests that are available but needs to be rolled out and approved by the FDA on a wider scale, then we could actually stop and contain this pandemic until the vaccine comes. Later in 2021.
Yeah, this is so interesting. The Washington Post had a piece about this. Actually, it looks like it's out today. There's one test, Saliva Direct, developed by researchers at Yale, and they say that this was funded by the NBA, the Basketball Association. Is that right?
I'm not clear about the funding source, but the researchers behind it, and there's another team at Harvard who's been advocating for it. The saliva is as good currently based on the latest research as the nose. And the saliva is obviously much easier to reach than the back of your nose, nasal pharynx, with that long swab stick that they previously needed to stick onto the back of your head. But I think that could be the ultimate solution here because it's cheap. It's easy, it's non-invasive, it gives you rapid results in minutes, and it could be done on millions of people very easily at home. And that is what is needed. People need to know, and knowledge is power, and testing is power. And if you can make this available, that would be so incredible. But we need, you know, these approvals done. There's other companies as well. We need scale-ups on a huge, huge volume. And these are kind of things where if the federal government got more actively involved, it could actually make a huge difference if only they got, they had faster action. And fast action during this pandemic is a lesson. If you don't move fast, you're going to lose to this pandemic and actually pay for it with billions, if not trillions of dollars in economic costs.
The Yale researchers say that the test would cost just $10 to be run, but there's no time frame in this Washington Post article. Do you have any idea when these tests might be widely available?
Yeah, that's the problem. And the Saliva Direct is just one. There's others being developed that are actually less than $10. It's basically as simple as a pregnant home pregnancy test and could actually be less than a dollar each. But they have to be FDA approved. And FDA right now is kind of, they're in a very conservative mode in which, they're saying, well, this testing doesn't capture as many cases. They're treating it as if it's a diagnostic test. But what we should see it as basically, you should stay at home, self-awareness test. Because these self-awareness tests are really critical. And to get them approved, these $1 tests would be huge. But it needs to get over this FDA's kind of hesitancy over approving things that are much less perfect in terms of diagnosis. Again, diagnosis. The criteria, just whether it's breast cancer diagnosis, prostate cancer diagnosis, their criteria are much, much stricter. But they have to realize that this could actually offer much more superior public health benefits. And so right now there's this battle of philosophy in the FDA, but we need to get through that right now. And hopefully, I'm hopeful that within a couple weeks, we will have more of these available.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Eric Fagelding, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, an epidemiologist, and a health economist. He was sounding the alarm about COVID back in January. And today, we're talking about what we now know 6 months in, a little more than 6 months. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. The COVID-19 death toll in the U.S. passed 170,000 this week. And today we're talking about what we now know about this virus with Dr. Eric Fagelding, a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, an epidemiologist, and a health economist. We have a question about saliva testing. Let's hear from Lee in San Francisco. Oh, actually, Lee dropped off. Lee wants to know how she and others can promote this kind of testing.
Yeah, I think this, it's a matter of advocacy to the FDA. The FDA right now is stuck in this, again, a philosophical quandary where, you know, they want to approve things that are as diagnosis only if they have sufficient accuracy. And in certain ways, you know, as Dr. Mike Ryan of WHO says, you know, perfection is the enemy of the good. In terms of this pandemic, you must move fast and realize that imperfect information is really needed. And so it's oftentimes FDA is kind of shielded from public advocacy because it's a scientific body. But, Dr. Michael Mina, my colleague, former colleague at Harvard, he's been really advocating for it. And people should follow him on Twitter, Dr. Michael Mina, M-I-N-A. And I think it's really to realize, we've also put out videos that these testing could actually get people to get results faster. Instead of waiting right now 7 to 10 days for many PCR tests, if people instantly found out the results, they could actually isolate themselves sooner. and especially asymptomatic results could isolate themselves sooner, because we don't, oftentimes many people don't wear masks. And this could actually be a really, really good tool. But again, it's just one aspect of our toolbox. It doesn't mean we shouldn't wear masks and stop wearing masks, because wearing masks is still so critical for micro droplets, which are these aerosol particles that float in the air and could be infectious. And we know this because we isolated the air from 16, 27 feet away from a COVID patient in the hospital, and the particles in the air were able still to culture and infect cells as an actual live virus. So we know that these aerosols float in the air, and they're in the 6 feet rule indoors, just is not protective. So all the more important to wear masks and improve ventilation. And all these things, we need all of them. There is no single panacea, silver bullet to stopping the epidemic. But if we do all of them, we can slow down and contain the pandemic.
Since you mentioned asymptomatic people, the CDC came out with data showing that 40% of people with COVID infections have no symptoms. And mm-hmm. Nikki writes, how do we know when asymptomatic people are no longer contagious?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. The other question related to that is, how do we know if you're positive, if say you do have symptoms and you show symptoms, when do you stop being infectious from it? And both those answers, it's not perfect, but there's some evidence that show that, the culturable positive. So there's test positive, right? But the test picks up the virus's RNA. But sometimes it could be virus fragments that's, basically broken down instead of the actual live, whole, intact virus. But they've actually found that the culturable virus actually disappears after around 10 to 11 days after you show initial symptoms, on average. So asymptomatic is tricky because you don't have a time stamp of your initial symptoms. But presumably, it's about, from infection to symptoms would be about 5 to 6 days, and symptoms to no longer culturable positive is about 11 days. So I would say, assuming you know when you were infected, which again, always tricky, it would be about anywhere about 15 to 16 days afterwards, when the average duration until you stop being infectious. But again, that's average, which means 50% of people are still a little bit longer than that. So just to be safe, I think probably 3 weeks is the time when you stop being, actually infectious to others.
Well, thank you for the question, Nikki. Let's go to a couple callers. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Yes, I here in San Francisco, the response from government seems to be very confused, and they keep changing policies. And I was wondering if your guests could explain what the criteria are for keeping something open or closed. For example, why is it that bookshops were not allowed to be open, but marijuana stores were? And also, how about, why is it dentists were initially prohibited from seeing patients, now they can see patients, but still hair salons and places to get your hair cut and nails done are not open, and these people are struggling, and I don't see how much longer they can hold on. So can your guest elaborate on what methods these epidemiologists are using to come up with these rigorous policies that dramatically affect people's lives, finances, and their generation, the future of generations to come? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's two answers. One is, first of all, for a general area, the criteria for safe reopening is you need positivity, which is the percentage of tests that are positive, less than 5% for 14 consecutive days. That's for like a general state or county. That's the general rule from the WHO. But for individual businesses, this is really hard. You know, I would not, you know, use marijuana dispensary and classify them differently than bookstores. I think that kind of classification is really tricky. What I'd rather actually classify it by is the availability for ventilation in buildings and whether people are actually spreading them or not. Like, you can actually wear a mask in a hair salon. I went to one here in Virginia, and I think it's pretty safe if everyone wears a mask. And there's actually outbreaks in Missouri in which, actually not outbreaks, but basically the hair, the barber who actually had COVID but wore a mask, and none of their clients got infected. So I think if you wear a mask, it's really good. And the ventilation in buildings varies a lot. And if there's good ventilation or adequate ventilation and opening doors and windows, that actually reduces the risk a lot more than just classifying by what kind of business. But the restaurants, I think, are dangerous because you have to take off your mask in restaurants and bars. And bars, social distancing, and, you know, that's always a problem in bars, especially with alcohol. So I think restaurants and bars, you should keep them closed because you can't wear masks in them. But I think some places where you can wear masks, like in hair salons, I think are relatively safe. Dentist offices are tricky because the actual dental drills in your mouth can actually aerosolize the saliva particles that's in your mouth. But now we actually have potentially improved things such as PPEs for dentists that, but again, they're limited, but they're available that could actually reduce infection. Altogether, there is no foolproof way. Wearing masks is the key, but avoiding indoor demasking, such as restaurants and bars, I think that's really critical. And so I encourage public health officials in cities and states to reconsider approaches to whether you can keep your mask on and whether it has good ventilation or not. Just like, you know, restaurants, whether they pass health grade, building code. I think that's the better criteria than just arbitrarily no bookstores or no hair salons.
All right. Thank you for the question, Harry. We have another question from Ellie, who says, COVID-19 death is awful. It's the morbidity rate that is worse. So many people have lifetime issues from COVID. Let's spend some time on this, Eric, because we're learning a lot more. NBC had just an incredible report, and I linked it on our website if you'd like to watch, yourcallradio.org. In the piece, we learned that patients have symptoms weeks to months after they recover. They feel dizzy, they have shortness of breath, a fever, lung scarring, neurological damage. According to the CDC, one-third of patients suffer persistent symptoms at least 2 to 3 weeks after recovering. And then there's another study out of Indiana University. It's based on 1,500 COVID survivors, and they identified 98 long-term effects, including hair loss and blurry vision. So let's talk about this for a bit.
Yeah, the long-term clinical sequelae, the long-term risks and damage that it poses to your system is quite diverse. I think heart disease is already established. That's actually the reason that the NFL and also the college sports, especially, have basically shut off their season because of fears of myocarditis. It's this inflammation of your heart, even in young people. And similarly, we also know it causes and exacerbates diabetes. It hurts insulin function. Again, diabetes is so tricky because diabetes itself causes heart disease, causes strokes, and many other things like kidney disease and whatnot. So causing potentially diabetes is very tricky. And then, of course, there's a neurological where people are living in brain fogs. And we know it attacks the CNS. That's actually why people lose their sense of smell. They actually said, you know, the best way to tell the difference between flu and this is the COVID. If you're infected with COVID, you'll have most often smell loss and taste loss, which is actually a function to damage to the nervous system. So all together, it is incredibly. And then there's, of course, other inflammatory conditions that mimic Kawasaki syndrome in children that we don't quite have a name for it yet. It is really concerning. And there's cases of people needing lung transplants, although it's rare, but it still has huge damages, even if you don't need a lung transplant. But the exact percentage is hard to pin down because it depends. Most of these studies, oftentimes, some of them are done in hospital patients, which are much more severe than non-hospital patients. And so I would say it kind of depends, right? If it's a mild case, we don't know exactly what percentage of people with mild cases will have illnesses. And will they have it beyond just a month, 2 months, 3 months, a year? We just don't know. But it seems that there are lots of chronic illness problems. And altogether, all the more reason to avoid the illness. And all the more reason to ignore those who say, well, the mortality is low in young people. Hey, it's okay because, A, young people spread it to older and more infirm people, and, B, the long-term chronic disease illnesses is completely being ignored by our president and others right now. So please, please think of others, and also think of your long-term illness risk.
Speaking of children, a new review from the American Academy of Pediatrics and Children's Hospital Association found that 97,000 children tested positive during the last 2 weeks of July. This is a 40% surge. What do you think explains this?
I think it's explained by the fact that the virus is just naturally spreading. Young people are infectious, and they do get infected, both. You know, notice that's two different things. They spread to others, and they do get infected. I think they get infected as just as high rate as others. They just get sick less often, because I think that's the other confusion. When people say kids don't get it, what the science says, kids don't get sick as often, but they still get it, and they likely still spread it, because we've seen contact tracings in so many different countries. And actually in Ohio, that a lot of kids spread it to their family members. And that's also oftentimes the problem. If once one person gets it, it's really hard to isolate that person in their home. Oftentimes once a person in the household gets it, the whole family gets it. And oftentimes it can start with kids. And this is why the major concern with reopening. Not only kids are being infected, but it's infecting their parents and grandma and grandpa potentially, who are living with them at home. So the kids' epidemic situation is really, really concerning. And I think also teenagers, you know, those over 10 years old, all the data so far suggests that they spread just as much as young adults. So they are not any safer as a group whatsoever.
And just in the last couple of days, the University of Notre Dame, North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Michigan State suspended classes after, right when they opened, they had positive cases.
Literally within a week or two. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's connected to several clusters of either social groups, dorms, or fraternities or sororities, off-campus housing. But even before these, we've already seen outbreaks at Berkeley, at University of Washington. There's been so many epidemics among college students and college campuses, even this summer, without the full reopening. And once the fall semester kicks in with huge, huge student population, much larger than summer, it was only inevitable when these epidemics occur again. It is so hard. And the only plan to safely reopen is to test every student every 2 or 3 days. That's the only scientifically recommended plan. But right now, A, that plan doesn't come from the CDC. If it came from the CDC, other universities would have to follow it. But right now, it's not recommended by the CDC, but just independent groups of scientists. And we don't have the testing capacity to do every single student every 2 to 3 days, unless we have these other rapid tests, these paper saliva tests readily available. This is why it's so key. If we want our campuses to be safe, you really need to do rapid testing. Even the pool testing is not enough, because pool testing only tells you that someone in the pool has it, but not who, which means, again, massive numbers of quarantine if any dorm group in the pool tests positive. Everyone has to be quarantined. Altogether, it's just so hard to contain without testing, contact tracing, and other safety measures.
How concerned are you as we head into the fall?
I'm concerned about schools, because many schools are staying open. I'm concerned about many college campuses are still staying open, especially in these conservative states where they don't have mask mandates. And there's actually no registry about kids. You know, you think that schools, being public institutions, most of the time would have registries, but right now there's none federally. It's not being tracked. It's only being privately tracked. And this epidemic will keep being exacerbated potentially by the flu, because the flu will crop up again in the late fall, in the winter time, and there will be a lot of confusion. It'll be more strain on our testing system. Do I have the flu or do I have the coronavirus? And so many things, you know. Oftentimes, the illness is due to people being indoors. And as we approach colder weather again, just like Arizona during hot weather, people went inside for air conditioning and spread it to each other. As winter comes, we'll become a more indoor society again. The lack of ventilation will actually only further exacerbate this epidemic in many ways. And mask wearing, you know, there will be lockdown fatigue, and there's mask wearing fatigue by some people. Altogether, it's, you know, we're not built for the long haul to deal with these long-term crises, and that's just so revealing right now. And then the other problem is evictions and other job loss, destitution. Of poverty will only exacerbate so many other things now that the unemployment benefits are being cut potentially, eviction moratoriums are expiring. Altogether, it's very unfortunate all around.
Mm. Well, we have time for another caller. Let's go to Greg in the South Bay. Hi, Greg. We're almost out of time.
Yeah, I'll make this quick. I appreciate what your guest is saying. But I think there's a couple of problems. When I listen to people talk about this, the first two things that they talk about are tracing and the testing. And then they mention wearing masks and social distancing or physical distancing. I think that's just the reverse. You got to do all four. But the emphasis has got to be on masks and keeping your distance and not crowds. That's one thing. But secondly is this. New Zealand went, they did what was right. South Korea did what was right. And look what's happening there. They're now seeing a recurrence. My guess is this is going to hang on for a long time, and people have got to get behind. Like, we need a national mandate for mask wearing. That's it. I mean, if people don't do that, this is going to continue to get worse, and it's not going to be over for a long, long time, even if they develop a vaccine. So I don't think people are taking this thing as seriously as they should, although we're going towards 200,000 deaths. And I just think that that's something that has to happen at the state level, the local level, national level. They've got to get to wearing masks and telling people you can't gather in groups, et cetera. So that's it.
Yeah, I agree. The mask wearing, we need national and state level mask mandates. But my only concern is that under Trump administration, we're never in a million years going to get a national federal mask mandate. That's just not happening, unfortunately, and so I'm not holding my breath for that. And distancing, I absolutely agree. Distancing is a measure outside, you know, because outdoor distancing is somewhat beneficial because there's huge airflow. But distancing 6 feet rule is completely not a safe parameter anymore inside, given what we know about aerosol transmission and how these microdroplet aerosols hang in the air for 20 minutes to 4 hours and potentially even longer in stagnant air. And they float throughout the entire, they diffuse in the entire room. The only thing I would say, we say in public health, environmental health, is the solution to pollution is dilution. And so in this case, the solution to aerosol transmission is ventilation and dilution. And the problem is a lot of our schools have very poor ventilation. A lot of our buildings have very poor ventilation. Restaurants, public bathrooms. I didn't want to mention this before, and sometimes I don't want to scare people, but the reality is a lot of our public bathrooms, most of them do not have toilet lids. And most of the time when you flush, it actually creates a toilet plume, because toilets are perfect aerosolization devices. And these ventilation in a lot of the bathrooms are very, very poor. So even if someone used the bathroom, you know, 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes before you, it doesn't mean that the air is actually clear. That's why, again, mask wearing at all times is so critical. And we need potentially premium masks, if at all possible, because they reduce the dose even more that you receive. And even if cloth masks don't reduce all of the dose that you receive, because their main goal is to catch droplets, there's evidence that's emerging that it reduces the dose that you receive, and therefore the illness that you receive could be mild or asymptomatic illness, as opposed to severe hospitalization cases.
Well, Eric, unfortunately, really we are out of time, but we would love to have you back. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
Thank you. You too. Dr. Eric Fagelding is a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, an epidemiologist, and a health economist. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.